Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, so we're going to start. So for those of you who haven't been here, seriously, Michael will speak for about half an hour. We'll take half an hour in a questions discussion and finish no later than the top of the hour. When we go to questions, Michael, if you just speak to the end of the room, just make sure we pick this stuff up. If I repeat a question, it's so it can be picked up on our podcast here. It's not because your question's incomprehensible. It might be, it might not be, but we've got to pick it up anyway. So that, if I repeat it, hi Louis, that's what we do, okay? On the other hand, if you're up the front, and if I don't repeat it, it's because I think it's being picked up in the podcast. All right, so... Okay, folks, welcome to the Sydney Institute tonight for our discussion on, continuing discussion on the 2016, can we start again? Okay. Folks, welcome along tonight. There is a podcast here. Okay. Here we go. Thanks for coming along tonight for our continuing series on the 2016 federal election, and we have... Michael Danby making a welcome second appearance at the Sydney Institute. He was here about a year ago and we had that meeting down at the Gallipoli Club. Now, Michael Danby is well known to all of you, so I will introduce him briefly. He's the Federal Minister, the Federal Member for Melbourne Ports. He's the Shadow Parliamentary Secretary to the Leader of the Opposition and the Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for the Arts. And Michael Danby's addressing the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic... A Greens Liberal Party deal, question mark, and the future of Australian politics. Michael Danby, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gerard, and thank you to you and Anne for hosting me here, and to all of the devoted and illustrious Illuminati of the Sydney Institute for coming along, leaders of the opposition, premiers, heads of news services, all of you judges are most welcome, and I thank you for being here. particularly I wanted to say thanks to a person who I think we all admire as an unbiased observer of Australian politics, Anthony Green, the ABC's most impartial commentator. Green's politics have never appealed to me. I think some of you might have guessed that. Never more so than in the case of Lee Rhiannon's ascendancy here in New South Wales. Lee Rhiannon is an unapologetic former activist for the Socialist Party of Australia, which I often mispronounce and describe as the Stalinist Party of Australia, and hence an apologist for the Soviet Union. Her presence in the Australian Senate, in my view, is a studied insult to all of those millions of victims of communism, a totalitarian ideology for which Lee Rhiannon worked so hard and then morphed into the Green Party without any public explanation. Some years ago when I first ventured into the social media, I was astonished when in one of my first confrontations with Comrade Rhiannon on the barely rating ABC program Capitol Hill, it achieved subsequently 50,000 views on YouTube. Probably it was because during my confrontation with Green Party comrade Senator Rhiannon, I produced the once bestseller of Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry Sidney Block and British author Peter Redway on the abuse of psychiatry to torture political prisoners in the former Soviet Union. This televised confrontation led me to make the uncomplimentary observation that the Green Party number one senator in this election, who thanks to the Prime Minister's double dissolution election, needs only 7.5% of the vote to achieve a second term, that her politics resembled that of Alina Ceaușescu, the executed wife of the executed and unloved Romanian dictator. One would never have thought it possible, but my old friends from the Spencer Street Soviet, as the Age used to be called in its latter years, then published a half-page picture of Rhiannon and Ceausescu to accompany one of the very few accounts ever in that newspaper of any remarks by me. And this is what they produced. It was almost a half page in the... That one is not Elena Ceausescu, and that one is not Senator Rhiannon. But I just thought it was incredible that the Age actually did something interesting and published that huge picture. Let's just put this down over here. Yeah, thanks. The Greens were mortified. It wasn't bad enough that I said I preferred the Liberals over the Green Party at the last federal election. Senator Bob Brown publicly threatened before that election that he'd send me out to grow cabbages, presumed amusing reference to re-education through agricultural labour. Finally, on my way to economy class, one day on the plane to Canberra, I was confronted in the business class section of Qantas, where the Greens always sit, by Senator Scott Ludlam. And because of this picture of Rhiannon and Ceausescu that appeared in The Age, which I must admit I had nothing to do with, I'm pleased that it was there, he informed me that I was being sent to Coventry and no one from the Greens would ever speak to me again. They haven't, and I haven't missed them much. The Green Party may not be all ex-Stalinists, but with their secret conferences, their cult-like isolationism in Parliament House, and other behaviours, they certainly seem to have adopted Stalinist methodology. Senator Di Natale cultivates a groovier image on the front page of GQ magazine in his black skivvy and sockless loafers, but let's put appearances aside. Labor regards the Liberals as opponents, but the Green Party as our enemy. Perhaps some of the differences can be ascribed to differences in the culture and background of the two parties. The Greens Party draws their activists and MPs from high-income university graduates, usually of Anglo-Saxon upper-middle-class background. For them, financial security means the luxury to pick and choose one's political battles, to demand nothing less than an absolute, and to pursue concerns removed from the day-to-day experience of working Australians. I'm sorry, these are all generalisations, but I'm attempting to distill some of the differences between the two parties' leaders and if we can use Senator Rhiannon's kind of terminology, cadres, party members. By contrast, the outlook of the average Labor voter is informed by a lack of such luxury. Labor voters may work in jobs they do not enjoy or compromise on household spending because they know they have to make ends meet. They focus on job security and wage levels, not because they are morally deficient or don't care about refugees or whales, but because they do not have the luxury of not worrying about money. Labor people understand you can't get everything you want all the time, that life is hard, we need to make choices and accept trade-offs and compromise. With all the charm of spoilt trust fund children, the Greens Party leaders make no such concessions to reality. Coming as they do from many of them from a position of privileged irresponsibility, the Greens Party makes an art form of rejecting compromise. Governing a nation of 24 million people like Australia requires finding common ground and occasionally accepting an imperfect result for the greater good. Yet the Greens Party have a track record of cynically rejecting constructive dialogue and compromise. Whether it's their rejection of Labor's emissions trading scheme or their refusal to work with Labor and Liberal politicians on a bill to provide marriage equality if they cannot take sole credit for it. They claim to support working people yet pay their own personal nannies a pittance in breach of employment standards and exploit idealistic young people in internship schemes that pay virtually nothing. They oppose measures that would allow police and security forces to monitor potentially violent extremists and other threats if they do not even open their own party processes to the most basic media or public scrutiny. They oppose military intervention for even humanitarian purposes, yet call on snipers to kill dogs on the beaches of Tasmania. I'm not joking about that. That's Wish Wilson the other day. They claim to have evolved on questions of the Middle East, but continue to pre-select people who advocate for the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement without the faintest idea of the historic illusions of commercially boycotting Jewish businesses. The Green Party calls for openness and transparency in politics, yet close their party conferences, pre-selection ballots and even leadership contests to the media and the public. What other party, I ask this distinguished audience, would get away with that? They decry the effect of money in politics, yet accept the largest donation of Australian political history, $1.6 million from Graham Wood, the high-tech entrepreneur. They claim with a straight face they're different from other parties. Yes, they're different. They oppose virtually all national security legislation. All national security legislation. They want death taxes. Their policy is to close zoos and basically oppose border control even after 1,000 people drowned en route to Australia. I stood there in the federal parliament when the 50 people had drowned at Christmas Island and said publicly I was wrong. I was wrong not to understand that people coming by boat to Australia was a danger to those poor asylum seekers and that I had to support realistic policies that would see them received in other places in regional centres. They want Liberal Party preferences to get into national parliament. That's another of their differences. Now, that's enough of context. Back to the main game of the 2016 elections, the Green-Liberal deal. Let's start with the conventional wisdom of one of Dr. Henderson's favourites and mine, Tony Jones. A month ago, on ABC's Late Line, Jones interviewed Green Party's leader, Richard Di Natale, on the Liberal-Green preference deal, where our Sydney ABC heavyweight repeated the misunderstanding of many journalistic illuminati about this crucial sub-story of the 2016 election. Jones, do you categorically rule out any preference deal with the Liberal Party in any of these contested seats, Sydney, Grainler, Batman in Victoria and New South Wales and others? Di Natale, oh, Tony, we've already said we won't be preferencing the Liberal Party ahead of the Labor Party in any seat in the country. We just won't be doing that. We'll do what we've always done, and a number of elections we may do open tickets. Of course, the Green leader, Di Natale, was not answering the question of substance, even if the question was so obtuse as it allowed him to dodge. The Green Party leader wasn't ruling out doing a preference deal, he was only ruling out directly preferencing the Liberals. Of course, it's common sense that the Green Party never planned to directly preference the Liberals. As Adam Bandt announced yesterday, in the inner city, they're preferencing the Labor Party. To do so would alert their Green voter base that, quote, well, not quote, but how I describe them, this vanguard of the proletariat was getting out a little in front of the masses. How will the proposed Kroger deal with the Greens work? It means that the Liberals will preference the Greens ahead of Labor in Wills, Batman, Grainler and Sydney because there the Liberals will be are running dead in those four electorates. As a result, they will run third and their preferences will be distributed. So Michael Kroger may well decide who gets elected in those four electorates on Liberal preferences, including whether it goes to Labor or the Greens. Feeney and Khalil, two of our most formidable Labor moderates in Victoria, or two Green Party drones. Liberal how-to-votes are traditionally followed by 70% of Liberal voters. Senator Di Natale has continually dissembled to the media that the Greens have no pact with the Liberals. He told Barry Cassidy on Insiders last Sunday that the branches control preferences. One Green defector, Osman Faruqi, immediately responded on Twitter that Di Natale had himself drafted the Victorian Greens constitution, and he said this gave the state executive of the Greens that power. There is a word for such media claims, and it rhymes with tyre. Di Natale's Greens plan to run open tickets in marginal seats like Chisholm, Bruce, and perhaps the marginal seats of Corangamite and Dunkley in Melbourne. This will lower the percentage of Green preferences flowing to Labor. This may be sufficient to defeat Labor candidates in these marginal seats. The Greens will get their Liberal preferences in Sydney, Grainler, Wills and Batman, from their point of view, and the Liberal Party would be rewarded by open tickets in outer suburban seats, Bruce, Chisholm, Corangamite and Dunkley in, Corangamite's a regional seat, in Victoria. Tony Jones again displayed his fundamental misunderstanding of this Greens political manoeuvre in the second question. Jones. So what does that mean in a seat like Grainler, for seats like Sydney, for the ones with high profile Labor candidates? Are you going to preference Labor in those seats, or are you going to do the pragmatic political thing and try and defeat them by whatever means you have? Di Natale, in seats like Grainler and Sydney, we'll be preferencing the Labor Party ahead of the Liberal Party. I'm very confident of that. Now, given that Grainler is a Green Labor two-party contest where the Liberals will run third, the Green preferences are irrelevant. They won't be distributed. So once again, an ill-informed ABC host gave the Green Party a free kick and Di Natale the opportunity to escape once again on national television and pretend he wasn't doing a deal against Labor. They are not interested in keeping the bastards honest as that previous political incarnation. Tony, if I'm talking to him directly, the Green Party want to, as they repeatedly say, replace a centre-left party like Labor with a far-left Greens party. It's a power grab, Tony. That's what it's all about. The media has been too easily allowed the Greens to deny the preference deal by talking about something else. Adam Band dedicated an entire press conference to this diversion yesterday, announcing the Greens would preference Labor in inner-city seats, pointing to Batman and Wills, where their preferences, of course, won't be distributed. Cephologist Peter Brent asked incredulously on Twitter, Greens think they can pull the wools over Journo's eyes by announcing preferences to Labor in seats where those preferences won't be distributed. Surely not. I can't respond as well as ex-Green Osman Faruqi, who said, have you read this, the news, mate? This stuff always works. And the new it boy of political journalism, BuzzFeed's chief political correspondent Mark DeStefano, certainly didn't get it, so it's not just an ABC problem. When he asked his followers after the banned press conference yesterday, does this put the conspiracy to bed? Not even a political editor of the politically switched on BuzzFeed could ask the right question. If the Greens are preferencing Labor in the inner city, what about all the Liberal Labor contests that count in the outer suburbs? Corangamite, Dunkley, Chisholm, Deakin, Bruce. Barry Cassidy got closer without drawing out the full nature of this toxic pact on the weekend on The Insiders. So he said, Cassidy says, are you though going in negotiations with them on preferences, in the sense that that you'll run an open ticket when it suits you and they'll help you then? Di Natale. So, Barry, we've already said clearly we're not going to preference the Liberal Party in any seat in the country. We've also said that we'll do what we've done in elections for as long as I can remember, and let's let our branches decide. Now, of course, we know that's a nonsense. The Victorian State Executive decides what their branches decide in those crucial marginal outer suburban seats in Victoria. The Greens have identified 8 short to medium target seats by 2026. Batman, Wills, Melbourne Ports, Higgins, which is a Liberal seat in Victoria, Grainler, Sydney and Richmond in New South Wales, and Fremantle in West Australia. The Greens continually proclaim they can't match financially with the big parties, ignoring the fact that they receive the largest political donation in Australian history. But remember this, Labor and the Coalition are contesting every seat, most of them seriously. The Greens say they are contesting 8, 9 including the seat of Melbourne, but are really, in this election, focused on gaining less than that. They're receiving public funding, which they can concentrate entirely on those 9 seats. So you see the crucial difference between the Green Party and the two main political parties. We all have to concentrate on seats all over the country. In a contest, the Greens can spend their public funds in a very limited way, in a very focused way, on certain seats. And I've got a table which, when this is published, will be much easier to understand. But in 2007, when the Greens got 7.79% of the national vote, they got $4,370,000 of public funding. In 2010, when they got 11.76% of the national vote, they got $7,200,000. They fell back a bit last time in 2013, got 8.65% of the vote and got $5.5 million of public funding. So you can see it's a considerable amount of dough to have focused on inner city seats. 3 years ago, on the edge of the 2013 election, Michael Kroger went on Sky News denouncing rumours that the Liberals were going to do a deal with the Greens to defeat me in Melbourne Ports and return Adam Bandt in Melbourne. "I wouldn't do a deal with the Greens Party under any circumstances at all," Kroger said. He called it a dirty deal. In 2010, he told Lee Sales on Late Line, comparing the Liberals helping Adam Bandt in Melbourne in 2007 with Ted Baillieu preferencing Labor in the Victorian state seat in 2010. "There was a great deal of dissatisfaction," Kroger said, "with what happened in the seat of Melbourne. There was a lot of internal opposition. Any thought of giving preferences to the Greens, and Ted Baillieu and David Kemp and Tony Nutt have made absolutely the right decision. That was not to preference them at the 2013 election." In this 2016 election, Michael Kroger, who's now the president of the Victorian Liberal Party, is the architect of his own devil's pact with the Greens. This time, the Liberals will preference the Greens, as I said, in contests where they run third, including the Melbourne seats of Wills and Batman, possibly in Grindler and Sydney here in New South Wales, and in exchange the Greens will run open tickets in marginal Liberal Labor seats, including Chisholm Bruce and possibly Dunkley and Corangamite. Dr. Dina Tully protests, including most recently on Q&A, that Green supporters never preference the Liberals, yet the Greens are in fact know that these open tickets will lower Labor's vote in these crucial Liberal Labor outer suburban marginals. The truth is, all's fair in love and politics, but I would be appreciative, and I'm sorry to be use some French here, if the Black Wiggle stopped talking bullshit. As long as he was open about it, it would be clear to everyone. Anthony Albanese, Labor's feisty member for Gradler, outed one of the Green hardliners, the Green fundamentalist Jim Casey, who's his opponent in Grindler. Casey told an audience of far-left activists in Sydney some time ago he'd prefer Tony Abbott as PM to Bill Shorten because a re-elected Tory government would more likely spark civil disruption and bring about the end of capitalism. Where have we heard all of that before? I always thought that Kroger would have abhorred an opportunistic deal with the Green political party on principle. He should understand the effect of such arrangements, which really empty real political differences, legitimate political differences that we all have, of all substance. Liberal voters, as I understand it, are diametrically opposed to the Green Party on matters political, socio-economic and national security. Most people believe, ultimately, there must be some ethics in politics, and thus this Liberal-Green deal undermines, in my view, all that Liberal Party people hold dear. And in fact, a great man of the Liberal Party, former Prime Minister John Howard, has been warning against this since 2010. And he told me recently at an ASPIE conference in Canberra in April that he opposed such a deal. And he restated it to Paul Murray on the 25th of May on Sky. He said, quote, "The Greens are the real extremists in this election. They are not in Australia's interests." He's right. Why would anyone on the right or centre-right reject the idea that the Liberal Party should preference a far-left party over a centre-left party? Greg Sheridan, the Australian's respected foreign editor, accurately recounts there's been virtually no discussion of foreign policy during this election. All the while, he points out that the issue of an increasingly aggressive Chinese foreign policy, especially in the South China Sea, is taking place, where 60% of Australia's trade and 50% of international trade transits. What is the Greens' policy with regards to that serious issue? It was given at the Lowy Institute a couple of weeks ago here. Abandon ANZUS. What are the serious policy differences that mean Liberals should avoid this preference arrangement? First, serious Liberals will remember that even after the tragedies in France and the escalating atrocities of Daesh, including the lone wolf terror attacks here in Parramatta and in Endeavour Hills in Melbourne, the Green political party has opposed every serious piece of counter-terrorist legislation. All four tranches over the last 18 months have passed in the Senate, with the Labor Party passing privacy and sunset amendments to the legislation, but then voting with the government. In September this year, before Daesh killed 140 people in the streets of Paris, Australia began bombing Daesh headquarters in Raqqa, following a parliamentary support. The Greens' Dr. Adam Bandt, PhD Soviet jurisprudence, insisted that the Greens Party opposed even highly restrictive aerial bombing of Daesh military targets in eastern Syria. Greens Party Senator and Deputy Leader Scott Ludlam followed suit, declaring, "Our only contribution is to fan military flames." Just a week ago in Sydney, Di Natale told the Lowy Institute that the Green Party denounces our bedrock security alliance with the United States. How is that going to wash with the Liberal Party base, or indeed with the majority in the centre of Australian politics? Hi, Mary, how are you? Thank you. Greg Sheridan examined the substance of Di Natale's address. He said in a column entitled, "Faustian Deal Will Damage Liberal Brand." This is Greg Sheridan. Quote, "Greens leader Richard Di Natale's attack on the US alliance makes a mockery of Michael Kroger's idea that the Liberals preference the Greens ahead of Labor in this election," Sheridan argued. As if to poke us all in the eye, the Green Party leader concluded his cameo on Insiders last week with that emphatic point, attacking America, saying nothing about the Chinese. Last year, new Green leader Richard Di Natale claimed that Israel as a Jewish state was, quote, "not conducive to a two-state solution." And, of course, today we've had the Greens candidate in my seat pull out of the only public debate that she was participating in because the Jewish organisation that was co-sponsoring it had the word Zionist in its title. Now, the ABC's celebrated sephologist Anthony Green, who is here, estimates that Green open tickets historically have been worth 3% of the Green vote, which will go now more to the Liberals than would have been in a case of a directed vote. The leadership is cynically using the naivety of their supporters to help return certain coalition members to office. The effect of these open tickets reduces Labor's two-party preferred. Kroger knows this. Turnbull will also. How can any serious person concerned with the economic future and security of Australia support the prospect of a far-left party supplanting a centre-left party? Malcolm Turnbull, unlike John Howard, is sitting on the fence. Does he think so little of political beliefs and differences that he would be complicit in this Greens-Liberal deal? That there are no sufficiently held differences in politics, just game playing. If Michael Kroger instructs Liberal voters to preference the far-left party in Batman, Wills, Grainlaw or Sydney, Mr Turnbull should follow the advice of his mentor, former Prime Minister Howard, and rule out this plan. It's sheer chutzpah of Malcolm Turnbull to rail against the prospect that Labor would agree to a Labor-Greens coalition in a hung parliament. A bill of shorteners, of course, ruled this out, while his agents negotiate actual deals to give the Greens Party a leg up. Ironically, Kroger is trying to justify the deal. He told Sky recently he saw no reason to preference Labor anymore because of eroding support for Israel and New South Wales Labor. His solution, therefore, is to punish Labor nationally by defeating two of our most pro-Israel Victorians, David Feeney in Batman and Peter Khalil in Wills, and helping elect anti-Israel Greens instead. I implore Liberal voters in Wills, Batman, Sydney and Grainlaw to ignore Michael Kroger's dictate and preference a responsible centre-left party, Labor, over an irresponsible far-left party. Now, to conclude, what about Labor? In a worldview where there are no enemies on the left, which sometimes people say is the view of certain people at Fairfax or at the ABC, they portrayed the Greens Party as the slightly more idealistic cousins of the ALP, harmless lefties with a bit of an obsession about the environment. Confrontation over the years has forced Labor to realise this is a fallacy. We have spent too long indulging the Greens, not wanting to attack them and expose the unreality of their agenda and their fundamentally anti-worker nature of their outlook. But the majority of Labor's serious people, including and especially those on Labor's political left, now recognise the error of this approach. We share nothing of importance in common with the Green Party. We are the party of working people, while they are the party of hard left extremists drawn from elite classes in Melbourne and Sydney's inner cities. I would postulate, actually, we've seen a genuine sea change, a hardening of opinion in Labor with regards to the Green Party over the last few years. I acknowledge in our last term of government that Labor made an error of entering into a parliamentary alliance with the Greens. Perhaps the only good thing to come out of this mistake was the determination never to repeat it. Once bitten, always warned. The Labor Party might be a lot of things, but we won't be entering into any deal with the Greens Party again, as far as I can see. Labor leader Bill Shorten has comprehensively ruled out any form of coalition with the Greens Party. I support him absolutely because of the internal cultural change. It's almost superfluous to say that such an arrangement in the future would happen with my cooperation or vote. As far as the Greens Party is concerned, I'm the wombat on the Hume Highway. The semi-trailer can run over you as many times as it likes. The wheels can all bounce, but each time the wheels will bounce because the wombat doesn't give up. However, with the benefit of such hard-earned wisdom, I feel that the Liberal Party are on the verge of making a mistake. Across Australia, including in my seat of Melbourne Ports, the Liberals are poised to enter into a deal with the Greens Party for preferences in this election. It would be an error of disastrous proportion for the country, not for the Labor Party. This is the point I'm making. Put aside the obvious class of ideology and principle that such a deal would represent. Put aside the rage and revolt that such a decision would have from branches and members of the Liberal Party. What I'm principally concerned about is that this might force Australian politics permanently further to the left. Obviously, as a Labor man, I want Malcolm Turnbull defeated. That's my top priority. But substantial Green presence in the House of Representatives is the worst possible result as a long-term outcome of this 2016 federal election. It will permanently shift the political goalposts to the left. Whatever its flaws, Australian democracy and our country are a substantially better position than virtually anywhere else. In the era of rising China, hopefully peaceful rise, we need an Australian body politic that will encourage the world's principal democracy, the United States, to stay engaged in this part of the world. And I'll conclude on this point, Gerard. The last thing we need is the Green Party plan to entrench a neutralist, pacifist Australia, sending a message at this moment exactly of the exact wrong message of preemptive kowtowing and appeasement at a time when we need to show quiet resolve, working for peace and building our defences and strengthening our traditional alliances in a uncertain future, strategic future. Opinion polls are tight. No one can foretell at this stage who will win the main electoral battle. Meanwhile, in Melbourne Ports, Batman, Sydney and more, a side battle is being fought that may drag Australian politics, as I've warned, further to the left. All Australians will be affected in the long term by this. It's not, as some press gallery cynics portray, a postmodernist tactical ploy, all parties being as bad as each other. A fateful ideological door is being opened by a person who should know better. In battleground seats like Wills, Batman, Grainler, Sydney, Bruce, Chisholm and Melbourne Ports, the future direction of our political system may be being decided. Voters have a clear choice, even though the Greens, with the assistance of some people in the media, are trying to obscure it. Thank you.
Thanks to Michael Danbury for an important address tonight. So we've got to the top of the hour. We've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. So can I just start off, Michael? As you know, the Australian Electoral Commission, I think tomorrow, announces the candidates who are beyond the ballot papers. And then I guess tomorrow night, Saturday, the party machines will determine the preferences with a view to printing the ballot papers before early voting commences on Tuesday. So there are two issues here that struck me from your important paper. I mean, there is still time for Michael Kroger to change what appears to be his position and not preference the Greens ahead of Labor and the seats you've mentioned. But there's another side to this too. I mean, you mentioned some coalition seats. I mean, there's still time for the Labor Party to preference Kelly O'Dwyer ahead of the Greens and Higgins, as you are doing in Melbourne Ports, and there's still time for the Labor Party to preference the Coalition ahead of the Greens in the seat of Richmond, where the Greens think they're in with a chance. So there's an obligation here on the Liberal Party, but there's also an obligation in certain respects with respect to the Labor Party.
That's a fair question, I've made my views and taken my actions in the past, which I hope have meant that I am personally consistent. There is also a wider picture, Gerard, too, and that is that in the seat of Mayo, Liberal Party candidate Jamie Briggs versus Xenophon. What does the Labor Party do if they run third there? We all have big political choices the future and in the next few days on this. In Higgins and in Mayo, and as you pointed out, I didn't think about it, but you're probably right, in Richmond too. So I would argue for political consistency, but I believe, of course, you know, people are involved in pragmatic politics. So I can imagine that, and Machiavellian politics too, people would see the situation that Kroger has postulated in, particularly in Wills and Batman in Melbourne, and as the newspapers have suggested, there might be some horse trading with seats in South Australia. So you would back off in Wills and Batman, Michael Kroger, and we may do something in Mayo to support, as the Labor will run third there, with Briggs over Xenophon. Frankly, I don't see, from a Labor point of view, much benefit for Nick Xenophon, lower house candidate, over Jamie Briggs. And if it meant saving Peter Khalil, for instance, if it was a one-for-one deal, if we're all taking hostages, I think I would do pretty much anything that's legitimate to save Peter Khalil. Peter Khalil is a friend of mine, I have to confess. He is a paradigm of the success of Australia. His father was an Egyptian Coptic doctor who couldn't practice medicine in Australia and worked in factories to put his children into higher education. Peter delivered pizzas and then worked at the Brookings Institution. He didn't go from one straight to the other. There was a period of high education in the meantime. He is a fluent speaker of Arabic. He is the apple of the Coptic community's eyes all around Australia. And I just think he would have an absolute adornment to this parliament to have someone from that background of Australia in the national parliament. I mean, there's no quota for, you know, Copts or Jews or Vietnamese or Muslims or whatever, and neither should there be. But wouldn't it be wonderful if, on the basis of his talents rather than as being defeated by some tactical ploy, he was able to make it? And I'd be prepared to have Jamie Briggs back if the price was getting Peter Khalil.
I should also say that Peter Cahill has always been a very good friend of the Sydney Institute. I wish him well. I just should also say that the podcast of Michael's address will be up on our website tomorrow morning. Right, so where do we have Anne?
I know last election was a kind of very good one for the Liberals, but in your seat, you've got a very high percentage of Liberal voters. And when you say they're running dead, does that really matter in an educated electorate like yours? I mean, you're not really in a West Melbourne, you're in a South East and East.
Mm. Oh, look,
and they would, to me, they might run second, but they ran first last time. They got a bigger, much bigger percentage than you, and you got in on Green's preferences.
Well, that's true, and there's a couple of points about that. First of all, I'm not worried about me. I'm not making this speech because of me. I'm worried about the effect on Australia of this election of a tactical manoeuvre that I don't think people have thought out the full implications of. I'm big, bad and ugly enough to defeat the Greens in Melbourne Ports. Of the last four elections, I've come twice first, and the Liberals have come twice first. So there's swings and roundabouts in politics. I'm not particularly worried about them. They are seeking to build up their base so that they will eventually get ahead of Labor, and hope that on our preferences sometime in the future they will be able to contest with the Liberal Party. So it's not a personally a base thing. I've got a fantastic team of people. We're very well organised. They've got one of the last old right-wing Labor Party machines that still works, that have all the people who are branch members and who pay their own fees, Barry, who turn up to polling booths. It's the old world of politics. I'm very proud to have sort of kept it going, but it's politics as it should be, if you ask me. So it's not a personal thing. I'm worried about the shift to the left. They can preference the Greens in and the Liberals each other via this open tickets versus third rating preferences in other seats, and have that effect. It could have a big effect on this this election, especially if you think, extrapolate what I've said to a hung parliament.
Right, so yes, question there. Yep.
Mr. Jamie, I mean, get away from perhaps the politics as you talked about just for a few minutes. You're a very experienced parliamentarian, and as I understand it, you've spent some time on a parliamentary electoral committee. In your view, is there any reason why voting is not electronic now, and would that get rid of or certainly minimise a lot of the double and triple voting which is set to go on?
I guess the suggestion is you've spent time on committees concerning elections. Should we have electronic voting, and would that minimise the double and triple voting which allegedly goes on? Mm.
Well, first of all, the last point first. There isn't much evidence that there is double or triple voting. The main evidence of it was about 30 or 40 cases in 1 year in Queensland and Northern New South Wales, where people were actually using their electoral enrolments to avoid problems with car registration. One has incurred fines in Queensland. One needed to prove one lived in New South Wales. I remember over a series of five electoral events, including a referendum, I think that's 1990 to 2012, there were 72 proven cases of electoral fraud, and in those five electoral events there were 72 million votes. So that's one fraud per million. I think Australia has a pretty good record. That's not to say that electronic voting isn't a wave of the future. It might be a very good idea. I'm disappointed, I'm sure Anthony Green is too, that only 90% of Australians are actually enrolled. 90% of those eligible to be enrolled, including a very large number of 18-year-olds who will not be able to participate in this election. And I think I don't know why it's not possible, if you're going down your road about electronic voting, why the Electoral Commission can't, with birth, deaths and marriages, automatically enrol people when they're 18. Your 18th birthday, boom, you pop onto the electoral roll. It seemed to be a lot more efficient way than chasing endlessly via the media, begging people to get on the electoral rolls, just as we do now, thanks to changes that I was involved in the mid-2000s, when people change their address via the Transport Accident Commission or via their power company or whatever, the Electoral Commission sorts all of that data and fixes your address so that you vote in the right electorate and that all of this is adjusted without having to rely on snail mail backwards and forwards when you know that only 20% of people will send you back a snail mail confirmation that you've actually changed address. So when people turn up to the polling booths these days, you find that many more of them are enrolled at the right address than ever before, and I think that was a useful change. But there could always be improvements to Australia's democratic system, but I think we've got a very good one compared to the poor old Americans, for instance, who are our democratic cousins who have, sometimes they have pencils, sometimes they have hanging chads. They have different systems according to different counties and states. I mean, to me, it's absolutely crazy that the world's primary democracy has different ways of people voting in different states, completely different methodologies, which obviously lead to problems like the Gore Bush one we had in those fateful votes in Florida.
My question speaks to the point you made at the end of your talk, Mr. Danby. Do I understand you to say that in the event that the difference in seats in the lower house between the Liberals was, say, one or two, and there were three Green MPs, that the Labor Party would not ally with the Greens to form a government?
A very interesting question, and absolutely firm on the answer. I cannot believe, after all of our experiences with the Green Party and the mistake that we made last time, that we would do anything else than not go into coalition with them. But the problem is that the Liberal Party may be in the same position. They may not have majority if there are two or three Greens there as well. So what happens? We may have to go and do another election. I would prefer that rather than Labor going into coalition with the Green Party.
My question, sort of supplementary, was not what would you prefer, but what do you think will happen?
Bill Shorten's doing quite well in the opinion polls at the moment. There's a Chinese saying that a rising tide lifts all boats. So I presume that things are going to be quite close. In those circumstances, if, two or three seats, two in Melbourne and one in Sydney, were lost to the Greens, that is quite a possibility. And if the tide wasn't as high as it is in Victoria, you could also have Labor losing a couple of seats where transition is taking place in Bruce and Chisholm to sitting members of Left, and you've got two neophyte candidates who are running against Michael Kroger's former wife, Helen Kroger, in one case. That means that it's possible, with the difference of a Greens open ticket, that the Liberals would win those two seats. Now imagine if you're a idealistic young Green voter or Labor voter, and this manoeuvre of Greens giving their open tickets and Liberals giving direct preferences results in, although there's a change in mood in Australia, that the current government is re-elected on the basis of this manoeuvre, I think that would be very bad for Australian democracy. Very bad. A change in mood should reflect, and a change in people's voting should be reflected in the change in seats and the change in government.
Question there? Yep.
Is there any objective evidence to establish precisely how significant these, quote, giving of preferences, quote, in fact actually are in practice?
Yes.
What's the evidence that the preferences distributions work for the parties?
They're incredibly effective in most cases. But the crucial thing is, it's not common sense to think that if, Michael Kroger ordered you to walk off St Kilda Pier, you wouldn't do it. But if if he ordered voters in Batman and Will's to vote Green, which is effectively what they're doing, 70% of them will do it. That's the reports of the various expert cephologists that I've read. A how-to-vote ticket by the Liberal Party will not lead to a mass revolt, as you might think, because, frankly, voters are not as informed as people in this room. And some people, you know, will just trust the political party that they support to do a how-to-vote card that reflects their views, whereas the how-to-vote card may not. But the Labor Party got in tremendous trouble over doing this in the Senate one time, where we put family first higher up the preferences because we were hoping to get Jacinta Collins, our third candidate, up. It didn't work. We were hoping to get the family first voters feeding to us, but in fact worked the reverse way around. So these kind of manoeuvres can deauthorise your political party with your own supporters.
How many of the 70% would have voted the same way regardless?
I don't understand. How many what?
How many of the 70%
well,
would have voted...
Well, I think he's answered that. The question is how many of the 70% would have voted that way regardless, but I think you're saying they vote the ticket. That's what happens.
Yeah, so if the 70%... If people were told to vote Labour, 70% of them would do that. There's a second preference. If 70%, if they were told to vote Liberal, to vote Greens, 70% of them will vote Greens.
They're following the ticket.
They're following the ticket.
Yeah. Right.
Because there's no party on the ticket, is there? There's only a name.
There's a name and a logo now.
There's a name and a logo.
But Liberal Party voters follow the ticket. That's what
they're disciplined. Yeah.
Yeah.
Given your dissertation tonight, Mr. Denby, in terms of what's happening in Melbourne Port, and in answer to the question over here in regard to electronic voting, if Paul Keating's Australia card had got up, you would have what you wish for in terms of being registered from the time you were born when you were 18 and enrolled.
So the question is, if Paul Keating's... Well, hang on. Hang on. I've got to get the podcast to hear this, you know. The suggestion is that if Paul Keating's Australia card had got up, there wouldn't be any trouble with enrolments. Okay? Now, what's the point?
The question really is, given what you've said tonight, and given the fact that the Labor Party brought about preferential voting, would you prefer a system where it was first past the post in Melbourne's ports, or do you support preferential voting?
Okay. Do you support preferential voting, or would you prefer first past the post? But it's a bit theoretical, isn't it? Go on.
I support compulsory attendance voting, which is what we have in Australia. Where you can go, you don't actually have to vote. You can go there and turn your ballot into a paper aeroplane once you've signed off. I don't encourage people to do that. But I do support compulsory preferential voting because I look at the United States presidential election as a paradigm of the opposite. So when people vote in a contest where less than 50% of the American people vote for the most powerful office in the world, I think that's terrible. I much prefer a system wherein constituencies, there is a result where people have to give preferences, and that means that someone gets a majority. You actually represent a majority of people. To elaborate a bit on my answer to Anne before, I should have said this. The green preferences I get in Melbourne Ports are completely different from the orders of the Green Party bosses in Melbourne. They could order people in Melbourne Ports to vote Liberal and they wouldn't do it because, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a bit of a softhead. I support, I'm the president of the Parliamentary Friends of Tibet. I'm a bit of a softy on animal welfare issues. And the voters actually know that because to them those issues are very important and they actually know what they're doing. And in fact, most Green Party voters are, if there's an open ticket, will give the majority of their votes to Labor, 70% or plus. The last election, I got 87% of Green Party second preferences. And partially that was because people know that I'm so hard to the task on issues that are of no importance to anyone outside Melbourne Port, such as the Grand Prix and other local issues.
So in your spare time, you're a bit of a sandal wearer, right?
I'm a sandal-wearing right-winger.
John?
Could you just clarify an answer you gave earlier when you were talking about a possible result in this election? Do we understand you, in relation to the position of the two major parties, that in actual fact, if neither of the parties has a majority, either the Coalition or Labour, has a majority in the House of Representatives, we are not going to have a hung parliament, we are going to have another election. Is that what's to be understood?
No, not exactly, because I don't know how many independents will be elected, and I don't know the nature of those independents. I think Labor was previously there with the support of Mr. Windsor. If he was to beat the Deputy Prime Minister, I think, and it was an issue of one vote, I could imagine Bill Shorten could more than hold his nose if it was a matter of being Prime Minister by having Tony Windsor on his side. But if the Greens were to form the three, a sort of a balance of power of three, that would be much, much more difficult for everyone. I cannot conceive, given the bitterness that most of the Labor Party feel towards the Green political party these days, that we would go into coalition with them. It's not only that the leader has said that we won't, I'm telling you that culture has changed. When I first said that I was not giving the Greens preferences in my electorate, there was a great deal of silence behind me. I was worried that I was getting a little bit out in front of my my colleagues. But have a look at any of Albo's broadcasts on YouTube these days about that issue, and you'll find he sounds like Gerard Anderson. Which is nothing bad, and I absolutely agree with Albo. Do you want to give Anthony a question?
Yeah. Well, hang on. Yeah, well, Anthony, and then behind Anthony. Yeah, go on. You've already had a question down there. You've had two. Yeah, Anthony. Yep.
Just want to correct one thing there. The preferential voting was never introduced by the Labor Party. It was a consequence of the formation of the Country Party in 1919. And it's, so it was never ever introduced by the Labor Party. But Labor did try to introduce optional preferential voting. Since 1990,
got off the issue entirely. How long do you think it is before the Liberal Party start to move towards optional preferential voting,
so they don't have to make this decision on preference?
Right. How, do you think how long will be before Labour as it moves to
optional?
The Liberals.
Before the Liberals move to optional preferential voting.
What is optional?
Optional preferential voting is you can give preferences, but you don't have to, and it's a virtual first past the post system. Okay. Now. There are many, many people in the Liberal Party who already support that. They would like to get it through, but I don't think they can, because there is a group in their own party who support the continuing process of preferential voting. I think they've had an experience in Queensland recently, which still has an optional preferential system that isn't entirely to the taste of the Liberal National Party as they're now constituted, the Labor Party would certainly insist, fight to the death on the issue of preferential voting, not because we love the Green Party, because they're our voters who are voting for them, who are protesting against our asylum seekers policy and ultimately come to us.
So question behind Anthony. Yep. Yep. No, you've had two. No. There. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There and then. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Given that the Greens are anathema to the Labor Party, and that the Liberal Party is anathema to the Greens, what are the chances of a party, if in the event of a hung parliament, a parliament of national unity?
No. What's the prospect of a parliament of national unity between the major parties?
Well, that's actually a logical question, isn't it? But it it won't happen. We have too much traditional antagonism, and also, you know, there's the issue of brand definition. You know, you don't want to be associated with the other side too much. You've got to have matters of difference. But I would say to you, on matters to do with the safety of Australia, matters to do with national security, every single bit of legislation after every bombing and every terrible incident we've seen over the last few times. Dreyfus, myself, a guy you probably don't know called Anthony Byrne, who's the Deputy Chairman of the Intelligence Committee, have taken Tony Abbott's roughhouse legislation, refined it a bit, put in a couple of privacy amendments, and then we've voted with the government, and the government's voted with us in the Senate. The Greens have opposed us on every occasion. And so, you know, I don't know what would have to happen here in Sydney with some of the extremists for them to get on board and to consider the safety of Australians.
Final question, Malcolm Kerr. It wasn't your hand. Okay, no, it's not your hand. No, you all had questions before. So there's a final question, Andrew. Yeah.
Michael, your Greens Party opponent on the board today announced that she was boycotting a candidates debate to which she previously accepted the invitation because she's by Zionism in Victoria. Usually in Victoria, the Greens have been careful to avoid the more incendiary takes on Israel that we'd associate with New South Wales Greens. So do you read from your opponent's decision that Lee Rhiannon's influence is spreading to the other states?
So there's a question about Lee Rhiannon's influence, because the suggestion is that usually in Victoria the Greens are less hostile to Israel than in New South Wales, but this boycott of your meeting coming up might indicate a change in that direction. Final comment.
It's an absolute free kick for me and for the Liberal Party. It's you don't agree to a debate and then say because you don't like the 25% of your constituency or holding it that you won't turn up. I have to out him here. My son and heir, Byron, made a very funny point on Facebook. He said it's like going to Bega and refusing to eat any of the cheese. I can't believe it that she has actually done that. It's the worst of all possible worlds for her, and she's absolutely unmasked the sort of extremist foreign policy agenda of the Green.
We have other questions, but we have a rule of finishing on time, and we've just hit 60 minutes, so it's time to finish. Well, many thanks to Michael Danby for coming to Sydney tonight and talking to us on the possibility of a Greens Liberal Party deal and the consequences of such a deal if it eventuates, and other matters relating to the influence of the Greens in Australian politics now and into the future. It's an important address. We'll be pleased to have it on our website tomorrow and publish it in due course. For the meantime, can I just say well done tonight and good luck on the 2nd of July.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.